Hello, my friends. Dr. Ken Berry, family physician, here with you today. You may know on this channel, I like to talk about controversial studies, topics in general, studies in general. And I have a guest on today who is one of the preeminent authorities on cardiovascular health. He is, in fact, a cardiothoracic surgeon who you can see in the show notes was trained at some fairly prestigious institutions. And he has some concerns about low-carb diets, keto diets, carnivore diets, and heart health. And so I wanted to have him on today to discuss these controversial topics. Many people who are follow this channel are eating a ketogenic or a ketovore or a carnivore diet. And I really think you need to listen to what this heart surgeon has to say about that. You may be surprised, and it may actually change the way you think about human nutrition. So I have Dr. Philip Ovadia on today, and let's bring him on. Hey, doctor, welcome.
Hey, Ken, good to see you again. Good to be back with the group here. Really excited to dig into some of this. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned some of the institutions that I trained at. And one of them in particular, I think, stands out these days because I did my cardiac surgical training at Tufts University. And of course, Tufts has been in the news lately around nutrition, and the School of Nutrition there and the head of the School of Nutrition has released that most recent scoring system for food that famously put, I believe it was Fruit Loops over eggs and meat. That's a little bit of a shame. That the good name of the institutions that I trained at are now being associated with such things.
Dr. Ovadi is talking about the Food Compass that is recently released by the Friedman School of Public Nutrition and or Nutrition and Public Policy, and it scores all foods from healthiest to least healthy, and they literally give a higher score to Lucky Charms, to Reese's Puffs, and to many other highly processed sugar-filled cereals, saying that you should give them to your children versus an egg scrambled in butter. That is going to be a healthier choice for your children. Now, some people find it a bit conspiratorial, Dr. Ovadia, that the Tufts School of Nutrition and Public Policy takes large checks, and they call them donations, from Kellogg's and Kraft Heinz and Mondelez and General Mills and Post cereals. Do you think that there's any connection at all between those very large annual checks that they get from these billion-dollar corporations and their decision, their learned, well-thought-out, considered opinion that you should give your child Lucky Charms versus an egg fried in butter? Do you think that had anything to do with it?
Yeah, you know, I think it certainly does. And, you know, I view it as the institutional takeover that's really so prevalent throughout medicine today. And it shows up in so many different ways. You know, when we look at our societies, the medical societies that are supposed to be representing, you know, the interests of doctors and patients, and we see that they too are, you know, heavily funded by the pharmaceutical industries, by the food industries, and the influence that that has. When we look at the committees that draft guidelines on various topics in medicine, we see the heavy influence of pharma and the food industry again. And quite frankly, you know, the majority of the research that gets done is funded by pharmaceutical industries. And of course, that research is going to be used to promote the interests of the pharmaceutical companies. You know, are they out there with the goal of, you know, harming people, harming patients? I wouldn't take it to that level. But I think it's just, you know, they're representing their own interests, and they, you know, the bias, quite frankly, you know, they probably don't recognize the bias. They think they're doing good. I do believe that most people have good intentions. They just are so blinded by the system that they are trapped within that they can't see the possibility that they might be wrong about some things.
I totally agree. And we're going to be taking questions from our private community during this live. And if you're watching this on YouTube as a replay, and you'd like to have access to ask your own personal health and nutrition questions to some of the leading authorities in health and nutrition on the face of planet Earth. And in my opinion, Dr. Ovadia, he is the preeminent voice among cardiothoracic surgeons when it comes to what you should eat versus what you should avoid. So if you'd like to have access to these leading authorities and ask them your personal questions, then please consider becoming part of our private community. There's a link down in the show notes. And speaking of which, I've got a question here from Pam asking for a friend, thoughts on cholesterol injections. And I assume she's talking about Repatha and Praluent here to reverse plaque and calcium in the face of extremely high cholesterol. What are your thoughts on Repatha and Praluent?
Yeah, so clearly we don't have any data that PCSK9 inhibitors reverse plaque. You know, the data that we have around this PCSK9 inhibitors, these very powerful cholesterol lowering medications that are delivered by injection, is that they do severely lower cholesterol levels. And in people with a history of heart disease, that has shown some benefit in lowering certain recurrent events, namely non-fatal myocardial infarctions. But, you know, there is a lot of controversy around the data. And again, we were talking a little bit earlier how, you know, the influence of the companies might come into play when looking at data. And the large study that was done to get the original approval for the FDA and in Europe for PCSK9 inhibitors, there was a group that recently went back and reanalyzed that data. Very difficult for them to do. The companies certainly weren't open with sharing this data. They had to, you know, do Freedom of Information Act requests in Canada and in Europe to get the data. But when they reanalyzed the data, they found that there were a lot of deaths that were attributed incorrectly to being non-cardiovascular deaths. And when you know, properly attribute those deaths, it turns out that there was no benefit to these medications. And in fact, there was a suggestion of harm overall cardiovascular mortality was actually slightly higher in the group that got the medications versus the placebo group. So
absolutely. And so, first of all, let's make everybody aware that that study you're talking about and all subsequent studies that got Repatha and Praluent through FDA approval and that they now show to doctors, all of those studies were designed by, funded by the actual company that sells the drug. And then the majority of the researchers either were employees of the drug company, or they own stock in the drug company, or they received a research grant from the drug company. And many people don't know that, but if you're in the research field, you're always looking for money to do studies because studies are expensive. And so if you can make a good partnership with a huge billion-dollar pharmaceutical company and maybe tweak the data just gently, just slightly, not doing anything that's just overtly immoral or unethical, but maybe leave this out, maybe misclassify this, maybe call this death some other reason than, oh, they were on the drug and they died, then that's going to establish a better relationship between you and that billion-dollar corporation with deep pockets and big checkbooks. Isn't it true that every single study that's been done about Repatha and Praluent was designed and funded by the drug company that stands to profit from the results of that study?
Yeah, as far as I know, there haven't been any independently funded studies that show benefit of these medications. And really, you know, also understand that the measure of success of these medications has become, do they lower LDL cholesterol? The outcomes really aren't even looked at anymore. You know, it's just, does it effectively lower LDL cholesterol? And it's just accepted as truth, as gospel, that if they're lowering LDL cholesterol, then they must be benefiting cardiovascular outcomes. And of course, we know, you know, we've had the discussion many times that those two things don't necessarily correlate. Those are some of the many reasons to question the science that's out there. The other thing to understand about some of these studies is if the results aren't in favor of the pharmaceutical company, they're simply not going to get published. You know, there is not a requirement to publish studies. We do have more stringent requirement these days about registering studies, and you have to declare that you're doing the study. But if you do a study, you know, and the study is supposed to last 2, 3, 5 years, as these studies often do, and at the end, the results, you know, aren't what you want them to be, and you just don't publish them. The reality is, you know, most people are going to forget about that. You know, they're not going to like remember that you even started the study in the first place. So oftentimes that's another way that the published scientific literature gets influenced, because negative studies just won't get published. Or if they do get published, they'll be published in some journal that no one ever reads. And, you know, they're not the studies that you're going to see hitting the headlines of CNN and the New York Times.
So then the question could pop up, well, how many studies were done about Repatha or Praluent that didn't show a benefit or that showed a negative outcome? How many of those studies were actually done? And the question, the answer would be, we have no idea, because that is considered by the U.S. government anyway as proprietary information owned by the corporation. Even if they received federal funding to perform the study, and so maybe they got $200,000 or $300,000 from the NIH, that is proprietary information owned by the corporation. If one of the researchers were to release that study, they would immediately be sued for millions, if not more, dollars. And so everybody knows to keep your trap shut if there's a negative result. And you're exactly right. They now have to register a new study that they're planning on doing. But if that study results, it doesn't turn out like they wanted to, that study can disappear forever. And that's, in my opinion, highly unethical, highly immoral, but it's not illegal. That's their intellectual property. That's how it's looked at. Now let's talk about Repatha and Praluent, because I predict that within 5 to 10 years, this is going to end badly. Okay. Because these things, they lower LDL. There's no question about that. And they lower LDL much more precipitously than do the statins like Zocor, Lipitor, Crestor. And in my opinion, that is inherently dangerous, because we know that at least one thing that LDL cholesterol does is it's very intimately related to the proper function of our immune systems, right? That's very, very important. And so when you start lowering people's LDL cholesterol down to 30 or down to 40 with Repatha or Praluent, that's not going to end well. And so people don't realize that they're like, well, they surely done research on that. No, my friend, they're doing the research right now. When you go to your doctor and you pay your copay and you wait for an hour and you get your Repatha prescription, you go home, you inject it once a week, they're following you. They're tracking you. You are the experiment right now. There is no long-term data right now. Everybody out there, if you're taking Repatha or Praluent, there is no long-term data showing long-term safety of either one of these drugs. That experiment is going on as we speak, and you are the lab rats. And so when something does come out of this that's terrible, like happened recently with Vioxx, that wasn't just an accident. That's the way it's set up to function. If something bad happens, we'll know about it in 2 or 3 years when you are having the problem. And so if any of you guys are out there taking Repatha or Praluent, you are the research, you're the lab rat. And that's you're on the back of your life and your health. That's how we're going to find out that these things are ultimately very, very bad for you. Do you have any, have you seen any research on lowering people's LDL cholesterol down to 20, to 30, to 40? Because many, I've seen many cardiologists on Twitter saying, I'd love to lower your LDL to zero.
Yeah.
What do you see?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there certainly isn't studies looking at that, as you said, with these new medications. You know, if we go back through the historical literature around cholesterol, we see that low cholesterol was a significant concern. You know, it was a marker of death, essentially, or risk for death. You know, if you look at older people, you know, not on medications, those that have a lower cholesterol level are at an increased risk of mortality. And, you know, that's because of things like cancer. That's because of infection. As you said, you know, cholesterol plays many essential roles in our bodies. It is the precursor for many of our hormones, and it is involved in our immune system. And, you know, to think that we should just be eliminating this from our bodies is a very concerning concept to me. And then, you know, now we are putting that into action. And again, you don't have to look hard to find other examples of, you know, medications that were thought to be very safe and they went bad. You know, you mentioned Vioxx, thalidomide is obviously a very prominent example. There were a number of medications related to the cholesterol issue that were developed to raise HDL cholesterol level, and they were demonstrated to raise HDL cholesterol. But they had, you know, many side effects and were ineffective in preventing heart disease. So it is not the same, you know, you can't just make the assumptions that, you know, moving these markers in the direction you want them to move is going to have the effects that you intend them to. And you also can't ignore the other effects that occur from that. And, you know, we refer to them, it's funny, you know, we refer to them as side effects. But the reality is we're not talking about side effects. We're talking about effects of the medication. You know, the effect of these medications is to lower LDL cholesterol dramatically. And to just say that that's not going to have any other, you know, ill toward effects in the body is crazy. And, you know, I see it now in my patients. I see many men who are coming to me and they're on these medications and they have extremely low LDL cholesterol levels and their testosterone is in the tank and they are suffering all sorts of effects from low testosterone. So that's one obvious, you know, short-term effect that I'm seeing. And then of course the long-term concerns around brain health and then around susceptibility to cancer and infection, I think are very real questions that we don't have the answers for. But yep. I like you, am very concerned about it.
Yeah. And so what we're going to see within the next 3 to 10 years, just depending on how many people suffer and how quickly, is that Repatha and Prevnar are going to be pulled off the market because the risk of life-ending infections goes up when you take them. Autoimmune condition, severe symptoms flare up, and also the risk of death from cancer goes way up if you're on Repatha or Praluent. So anybody taking those, you might want to just think twice about that. I'd almost rather somebody be on a statin versus Repatha or Praluent, and that's saying a lot coming from me. Do you agree with that statement?
Well, you know, at least I think with statins, the effects are less severe. And, you know, some of the side effects that occur with statins can actually be dealt with, you know, proper supplementation. I think the real problem with these medications, again, is, you know, the message that has been prevalent for the past, you know, 30 years now, essentially, you know, it was the late 1980s and the early 1990s that statins became the most widely prescribed class of medication. And the messaging is that this problem can only be addressed with medication, and you need to do it with medication. And it ignores the fact that we can have very powerful impacts on our risk of heart disease if we change the foods that we eat and if we address insulin resistance, because insulin resistance is the real root cause of heart disease. It is the real big risk factor for heart disease. And we
can, that's the perfect time for me to bring this up, and let's look at this. So this is a study that was published in JAMA Cardiology. Now, this study was just in women, but I think this is absolutely applicable to every human being on the planet. And so Dr. Avadia is saying what you're trying to do is prevent a heart attack. You're trying to prevent heart failure. You're trying to prevent early death. That's what we're trying to, all of us, everybody in the world. If you care about your life and your health, then you want to minimize the things that are going to cause you to die of a heart attack or die of anything else. And so when you crunch the numbers from that JAMA Cardiology study, then what we're looking at is hazard ratios. That means the risk of something bad happening because that the person has the following thing. And I've ranked these are the top 10 hazard ratios that came out of that very large study. And so if anybody out there is interested in not having a heart attack, not having heart disease, then you need to focus on the biggest pieces of the pie first and fix that, and then focus on the next biggest. Or you could just do what Dr. Avadia and I do, and we fixed our diet. And so we're working on all of these at the same exact time. Because what's your opinion on this, Doc? Do you think that every single piece of pie in the top 10 here that causes coronary heart disease, what part does diet play?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the only two slivers on that piece of pie that aren't affected by the food you're eating is smoking and inactivity, you know, although inactivity also, you know, usually tracks with not eating well. But, you know, besides that, all of these other factors do get influenced by insulin resistance and by the food that we are eating. And the reality is that none of the factors on this graph are actually influenced by statins. And people will say, oh, well, I see LDL there. But what you see there is actually small, dense LDL particles. And it turns out that statins really don't have much of an effect on small, dense LDL. They lower Right. LDL overall, but they disproportionately lower large, fluffy LDL. And they can actually make the small, dense LDL more of a problem. But insulin resistance is what causes LDL particles to shift towards the smaller size and become damaged and oxidized. And then, you know, everything else we see on this list is certainly related to insulin resistance. So that is the discussion that is the way that I have tried to shift the discussion around heart disease. You know, it's not, we can forget about the statin issue for a minute. We could, even if we wanted to accept, okay, statins are as great as they say they are, and they do everything that they say that they do, and all the published studies are correct, which obviously it's not. But if we accept that, we still can't ignore this graph, that it is only addressing a very small part of the risk pie, of the risk puzzle. And insulin resistance is the vast majority of the risk puzzle. So why aren't we addressing insulin resistance when we are talking about heart disease?
Absolutely. And when you see this information graphed like this, it immediately becomes a huge deal that the Tufts School of Nutrition and Public Policy, that they're recommending for both you and your children that you eat things like Lucky Charms and Reese's Puffs cereal and even cornflakes, because all of those spike your blood sugar, spike your insulin, are to at least some degree inflammatory in nature, and are also void of many of the nutrients, the vitamins and minerals, amino acids and fatty acids that your body needs. Now, Dr. Avadia and I both are eating a diet that will minimize the risk of every single one of these top 10 risk factors. And let's just talk, I would love to know what a cardiothoracic surgeon eats. I think that'd be good, relevant information. Tell us about your diet, Dr. Avadia, and why you're eating that diet to minimize all of these risks.
Yeah, sure thing. So, you know, my diet is a carnivore diet. You know, it is based in eating animal protein, first and foremost, and the vast majority of what I eat is animal protein. Typical day like yesterday, you know, around noontime or so, or even a little later than that, when I got out of the operating room, I had it was a flank steak yesterday, but oftentimes it will be, you know, a steak of some sort. And probably about 5 hours later or so, I had a pound of ground beef with a couple of duck eggs scrambled into it. And that's what I eat in a typical day. And I do that exactly because of what you said, you know, avoiding insulin resistance, avoiding all of these things. I've been wearing a continuous glucose monitor the last few weeks, which I do on an occasional basis. And my glucose just stays a nice flat line pretty much all day long, you know, within about a 10 point range. It will vary when I eat that way. And so it is addressing, you know, all of the things on this list by doing so.
Absolutely. And I think when you see this list, because type 2 diabetes, most people know what that is. That's chronically high blood sugar. Metabolic syndrome is chronically high triglycerides, blood pressure, blood sugar, and then a waist to height ratio that's you're too fat in the middle, basically.
Yeah.
Hypertension is high blood pressure. Obesity, every single one of these things is going to respond to having a lower average blood sugar. And this is one of the reasons that we all recommend you wear a CGM. Even if you haven't been diagnosed with prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes, MODY, or LADA, you need to wear a CGM for a few weeks so that you can figure out which foods really spike your blood sugar and which foods don't really spike your blood sugar. And I think probably the official recommendation from Tufts University would be, you don't need a CGM, because if you wear a CGM and you eat the foods they recommend, you're going to see very quickly that those foods spike your blood sugar off the chart. Now, you see number three on this list is hypertension. And I've got several questions from the tribe about hypertension. Let's get Maria's. She was just prescribed Carvedilol for HFpEF. Info says it may cause hyperglycemia. Absolutely. Should I be on a carnivore diet only, or is ketovore okay while taking Carvedilol?
Yeah. So let's first of all, translate that into English for some people yes. who may not be familiar. So HFpEF is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And basically what that means is that the heart is squeezing okay, but it doesn't relax like it should. And so therefore, we're not getting the same effect from the beating heart. And we can develop some of the symptoms of heart failure. Carvedilol is a beta blocker medication. So it's a medication that both lowers blood pressure, slows heart rate, and also has unique effects on the heart muscle itself. It really helps the heart muscle to relax some. And that's why that medication is useful in this situation. Hyperglycemia is one of the known effects or side effects of beta blocker medications, and you do want to be careful about that. And, you know, I would suggest that the best way to deal with this situation would be a, you know, carnivore, ketovore diet. And I say that for two reasons. One is that, you know, ketones are the preferred energy source for your heart. And being in a ketogenic state has been shown to have some benefit in heart failure. The studies are small. They're not, you know, large studies. Some of it is animal data that we're basing that on. But there is at least a suggestion that a ketogenic diet can help in heart failure. My clinical experience with patients is that it does help in heart failure. And so not only are you going to be avoiding the hyperglycemia from this medication, but you're going to be addressing the underlying condition. Carvedilol, that medication, is not changing whatever led to you developing this condition in the first place. Medications don't change the cause of the problem. They just treat the symptoms of the problem in most situations when we're dealing with chronic disease. So I think a ketovore diet, or, you know, carnivore ketovore diet in this situation would be a great suggestion. Obviously, usual caveats, you know, you need to talk to your doctor. If your doctor can't discuss this with you, find another doctor who can. You want to have medical supervision when you're dealing with conditions like this. But I would have no objections and would be firmly in favor of those dietary approaches.
Absolutely. Another question about blood pressure. 8 months on strict carnivore. I'm still on lisinopril for my blood pressure. Now, I'm assuming that you still have high blood pressure. You're not just taking the pill because your doctor hasn't stopped it yet. Will my blood pressure ever come down enough? I still have weight to lose. Now, let's start, doctor, with what do you consider a normal, healthy blood pressure? What's your cutoff? And then let's discuss that first, and then we'll get into the question.
Yeah, so I consider a normal, healthy blood pressure to be less than 130 over 80. Both of those numbers lower than that. When we get concerned about high blood pressure is certainly, you know, when it gets above 140 for the top number and above 90, you know, 85 is concerning to me, but above 90 is where you can really start to show harm occurring. So those are the numbers you want to be looking at. You were sort of alluding to it, you know. Are you on the medication because your blood pressure is still high, or are you on the medication because your doctor just hasn't tried stopping the medication? And, you know, this is something I run into often. You know, people will start low carb diets, and, you know, some people right away, you got to stop the medications because they start getting low blood pressure. They start getting dizzy and lightheaded. Other people I work with, their blood pressure stays about the same, and then we just take them off the medication and their blood pressure stays the same. Yep. And it just that the medication isn't doing anything and you can get it off it. But like you said, most doctors don't think about stopping blood pressure medication.
Yep.
Ultimately, to improve your hypertension, you need to address your insulin resistance. And this can take a while. You know, we do see significant improvements quickly with, you know, low carbohydrate and carnivore diets. But, you know, getting rid of all of the insulin resistance that for many people has been there for 20, 30, you know, plus years, it can take a while. And unfortunately, there may be some, you know, damage to the blood vessels that ultimately can't be undone. And you may not get off of all of your medications, but the vast majority of people, I can't think of one, you know, person that has been adherent to a low carbohydrate carnivore diet that we haven't been able to at least lower their medications.
Yes, I agree. Now, I have to ask you a somewhat controversial question, doctor. Why are you directly going against the American Heart Association's guidelines that the goal blood pressure should be under 120 and under 80? You said 130 over 80. What's wrong with you as a healthcare provider? Why do you not adhere to the AHA's? Obviously, that was based on research and rational judgment. Why don't you say 120 over 80?
Yeah, because, you know, that wasn't based on rational judgment. You know?
Oh.
Basically, what that was based on is that they came out with the original guidelines and, you know, medication-based approach lowering blood pressure and avoiding the complications of high blood pressure. And then they saw that it was ineffective. We weren't getting much of an effect. And their answer was, we must need more medication. We must need to drive the blood pressure lower. Similar to the cholesterol story. You know, we've been focused on lowering cholesterol for, as I said, 30 plus years now with medications, and we're not seeing the effects. Heart disease remains the number one killer in the United States and worldwide, despite the fact that our cholesterol levels are lower. And the answer from the pharmaceutical industry and their influence on our medical societies is that, well, we just need to lower it more. We must just need more medications. And instead, I, you know, and many others, you know, have stepped back and said, maybe it's the wrong approach. Maybe it's what we shouldn't be focused on.
Yep.
And again, when you look at the data around high blood pressure, we see that under 140, you know, until you get above 140, you cannot demonstrate harm.
Exactly. And that's exactly why I tell people in our private community, as long as you're resting blood pressure that's been checked properly, because very often doctor's offices do not check your blood pressure properly. There's a list of things that must be done for the number you get on the sphygmomanometer to actually be your real blood pressure. And I've got a YouTube video about that. But all the research shows that there starts to be a little harm if your blood pressure checked properly is averaging above 140 on the top, and then 90 on the bottom really is where the research shows the inflection point where you're like, yeah, you're starting to do a little damage there. Let me see. There was another good question. Where did that go? Here it is right here. Yeah. Yeah. So this is from Susan. She says, would 130s over 70 to 80 be okay for a 77-year-old? I stopped my Losartan a month ago. I'm still taking 50 of metoprolol. My answer would be for a 77-year-old, 130s over 70s is effing awesome. Okay, you probably no longer need the metoprolol either. What say you, cardiothoracic surgeon, Philip Ovadia?
Yeah, so again, I agree. I would be working on getting you off the metoprolol, and I would be continuing your dietary changes. You may need to tailor this to your individual situation. You know, if you told me you had had a history of a stroke, you know, that might change my thinking. If you've had other effects from high blood pressure, if you have a thickened heart, if you have, something like an aortic aneurysm, maybe that changes. But in general, I agree, 130s over 70s is going to be just fine for a 77-year-old. And there's a good chance that you can get off the other medications as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here's a question from Tamara. Wore a Holter monitor for 2 weeks due to left side pain in the arm, chest, and neck. No abnormalities on the Holter monitor. Cardiologist shrugged it off. Any other tests to determine what's going on? This makes me very nervous. I feel like this, if that was the extent of the cardiac workup, that was a half-assed job. What else would you like to see Tamara have checked?
Yeah, so, with pains, especially on the left side and the chest, neck, and arm, you want to make sure you are not having what we call angina, which is basically, think of it as a cramp of the heart. It's a sign that your heart is not getting enough blood, not getting enough oxygen. And a Holter monitor is not going to show that at all. So I hope that wasn't the first test and the only test. Again, explain some of the terms. A Holter monitor is a monitor. It's basically an EKG, a continuous EKG that you wear at home. So it's going to look for abnormalities in the heart rhythm, which doesn't really have much to do with the blood flow through your heart. So I would want to see some evaluation of, do you have adequate blood flow? That could start with something like a coronary artery calcium scan. In someone who's having symptoms, I probably would skip right to either a CT angiogram, which is a type of CAT scan that they give you dye and they can look for blockages in the heart. I might consider something like a stress test, although I really don't consider it as good a test as the CT angiogram. My preference would probably be in a situation like this, let's get a CT angiogram and let's see if there are any blockages in the arteries of your heart.
Yep. I totally agree. If the doc's not comfortable with the CT angiogram, you absolutely need some kind of stress test. You definitely need an echocardiogram. Surely to goodness, those things were scheduled and you just don't know about it yet. Tamara, if your cardiologist, if all they did for your symptoms, because most people know that in women, they very often don't have the classic symptoms of angina. If that's the full workup you got, you need to fire that cardiologist's ass and find another cardiologist ASAP. There's hundreds of reasons why you might have been having left-sided arm, chest, and neck pain, but until proven otherwise, you have not had a thorough cardiac workup and you need to find another cardiologist ASAP. Still could be nothing wrong. Don't worry, but do set up the appointment with another cardiologist. Let's talk about what's wrong with cardiologists, because you and I are having this discussion. We're both doctors. We're both rational people. We both want what's best for ourselves, for our family, for our children, for our patients. We want the world to be a better place, right? But the average cardiologist would completely agree with virtually everything both of us have said since we started this video. Why? What's wrong with the average cardiologist? Why do they recommend the things that they do? Where are they mistrained? Are they nefarious? What? Why do cardiologists get it so wrong so often?
Yeah, so I think this really goes back to our education and the system that, you know, we are a part of. I believe, you know, you and I graduated medical school about the same time. And by the time, you know, we graduated medical school, it was a given that cholesterol is the cause of heart disease. And the way to combat heart disease is to lower cholesterol, both with dietary changes and medications. And that was an unquestionable fact, despite there being plenty of evidence to the contrary. But we don't hear about that evidence. We only hear one side of the story. And that's during our education. And that's, you know, as we're in the healthcare system after our education, you know, talking to our colleagues and going to the meetings. You know, when you go to the American Heart Association scientific meetings, the science that gets presented is typically all in the same direction, you know, and they really won't even entertain the other possibility. And again, we don't have to go back that far, but the reality is there aren't many doctors still practicing who remember the pre-statin era. You know, again, the first statins were introduced to the market in 1987. So, you know, we're coming up on 50 years or 40 years, sorry, that statins are there. And so even the doctors who were 20 back then, you know, they're in their mid, late 60s now. And there aren't too many of them around. And yep. So no one remembers that prior to 1987, when you go through the literature around heart disease, you actually see a very contentious debate about whether it was cholesterol or whether it was sugar that was the primary driver of heart disease and insulin resistance related to the sugar. The work of the scientists around insulin resistance, the work of scientists like Gerald Reven, like Joseph Kraft, these have been largely forgotten. And so, you know, I don't ever remember hearing about either of those scientists during my medical school. I don't remember it in any of the books.
No, nor do I.
I think that's the environment that we're in. And so the average cardiologist just hasn't even considered that there might be an alternative theory. And that's the reality of it. And then they're so busy taking care of people with heart disease that they don't have the time to think about it. They don't have the time to ask these questions. And it's usually, you know, if something happens in their life that prompts them to start looking into it deeper. You know, so many of us in this community, Dr. Barry and I share the same, you know, background that we had a medical problem ourselves. You know, for me, I was obese, I was pre-diabetic, and I was headed down the pathway. And I started asking why, when I was following all the advice, was this happening? And yes, that's what led me to discover that there even was an alternative theory. And then it's been a lot of work to work through that. You know, it wasn't like I just said, oh, okay, the other answer is the right answer. You know, it's hundreds and thousands of hours of reading the studies, of, you know, listening to podcasts, reading books, you know, all of the research that has gone into it that makes me comfortable that this is the correct approach. But that takes a lot of work, and it takes a mindset of being willing to admit you were wrong.
Yep.
I have to admit, and, you know, I know you've done the same, that we were wrong. We treated patients in the wrong manner. We probably harmed people by doing so. That wasn't our intent. We just didn't know any better.
Exactly.
But to be able to admit that takes a lot.
And it does. Most
physicians aren't willing to do that.
True. And now what I've been recommending people in our private community do, and what I want everybody to start doing, because obviously the cardiologist, they are not going to hear this message from the top down. That's never going to happen. And so what we've started doing, and it's actually getting traction, doctor, is I have people print out this study from JAMA. And then in many of my YouTube videos, I'll have the research that I base the video on in the show notes. And I tell people, print out that research, take it to your doctor, because in many cases, the doctor has either never heard of that research or they heard a summary of it, but they didn't really think of it the way we're thinking about this. And so everybody down at the bottom is that there, you can print this study out yourself. Take it to your cardiologist and say, doc, how come every time I come see you, all you want to talk about is lowering my LDL cholesterol or my ApoB or some other thing, but I don't even see them on this pie chart. They don't even show up in the top 10. Why do you never talk to me about my prediabetes or my metabolic syndrome or my, you know, the cardiologists love to talk about blood pressure too, but not quite as much as LDL cholesterol. But you never talk to me about these other things with the same intensity that you talk to me about lowering my LDL cholesterol. Why is that? And I think when enough patients have asked enough cardiologists that question, they'll go, yeah, that is kind of weird, that because that's all I hear talked about is LDL cholesterol and ApoB. I never hear really about it. It's like, oh, type 2 diabetes, yeah, take your medicine. But what if there was a dietary intervention that would fix the top 10? That would be pretty cool. Now, here's a question that this is a very controversial question. From TM Cook, can a CAC score, you and I have already established, you cannot lower your CAC score by taking Repatha or Praluent or Crestor or Lipitor or Zocor. That does not lower your CAC score. There's no research that shows that. But have you seen CAC scores come down by changing the diet?
Yeah, so I have seen coronary artery calcium scores come down by changing the diet. Now, by changing the diet alone is always a little bit difficult to answer that, because, you know, the reality is that we never just change the diet. You know, we change our lifestyle. And for my patients with increased coronary artery calcium, I'm oftentimes, you know, in addition to the diet, you know, maybe recommending some supplements and, you know, we're changing around their medications. You know, to look at this a different way, I would say I've never seen a coronary artery calcium score decrease without changing the diet. That I think is the question we should be answering. You know, are some of these supplements necessary? Honestly, I'm not quite sure, but, you know, I think it's a safe bet. You know, when you look at something like vitamin K2, and I tell patients that, you know, you should adopt a low carbohydrate, you know, oftentimes mostly carnivore type diet, you should be getting a lot of vitamin K2 in that type of diet. So do you need to supplement with K2? The honest answer is I'm not completely sure, but you know, the safe bet is take the supplement as well. You know, there's really no harm in taking a K2 supplement. So I don't know if diet alone is truly enough. But I do know that without diet, you have zero chance of lowering your coronary artery calcium score.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you guys, from personal practice experience, I have seen multiple people eating a proper human diet. Dr. Adam Nally, who does CIMT scanning in his office, he's seen, and then also orders the CAC scan. And then Dr. Arthur Agaston, who is the cardiologist who came up with the CAC scoring system. We have all seen multiple people when they adopt either a ketogenic, a ketovore or a carnivore diet. And let's be very clear. This is a slow process. This is calcium in the arterial wall. This is not going to go away in a few days or a few weeks or a few months, but we all recommend that you repeat that CAC score annually, every 12 months. And so after what's supposed to happen, according to Dr. Arthur Agustin, the cardiologist who came up with the CAC scoring system, is the average adult, their CAC score is going to go up about 20% a year. That's normal. That's what we would consider average or normal. And so when somebody adopts a proper human diet, say they got a score of 100 on this first one, they repeat that in 12 months. What should have happened is it went up to 120, give or take, right? But when they get that score back and it's only went up to 105, that's a victory. Or it stayed 100, or it went down to 97. That's a humongous victory that the average cardiologist doesn't even know is on the table. Like, that's not even an option. It's going to go up. We just want to try to slow it down. But yes, well, and so there is, I'm holding my breath for research that will back that up, because we currently don't have any. But I can tell you anecdotally, there are thousands and thousands of cases of people who have lowered their CAC score, or at least slowed down the progression of their CAC score by adopting a proper human diet and a proper human life. I can tell you that anecdotally. There's no research to support that currently. All right, doctor, we've covered that. Oh, I know what we need to talk about. We need to talk about the miracle drugs, Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro. Yeah. These are all over the news right now. Ozempic, how it's hard. There's a shortage. Everybody wants it, needs it, but nobody can get it, or not many people can get it. Are you excited about the health benefits of Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, or do you have some hesitations? What do you think about these drugs, and what is your, not medical opinion, but what is your recommendation for the average person who's like, hey, man, I need to lose 30 pounds. Hey, man, I need to lose 50 pounds. Should these drugs be the predominant way they address that problem?
Yeah, I am not excited about these medications at all. I have not prescribed it for a patient as of yet, and I really fail to see the role in it because, again, as we discussed earlier, I don't think medication should be the first line in the battle against obesity. I think the dietary changes should be first, a low carbohydrate, you know, proper human diet, keto, carnivore. Interestingly, there was just some data, I believe I saw the article yesterday or the day before. It was a mouse study looking at the mechanism of action of these medications. And basically what it showed is, you know, they are blocking the absorption of carbohydrates or speeding up the excretion of carbohydrates. And so if you're on a low carbohydrate diet, there is probably going to be no benefit to taking these medications. As with any medication, I have concerns about the harms. And quite frankly, we know that when these medications are stopped, weight regain occurs. We know even if the medications are continued over time, weight regain occurs. And so, you know, the concept that we're going to have people on a medication for their entire lives as a way to combat obesity, again, it makes absolutely zero sense to me. So I am not a fan of these medications. I advocate for the people that I work with. Let's do the dietary changes. And then, quite frankly, there's no need for these medications.
I agree 100%. And I predict also that the Ozempic story will also end badly. I'm working on a YouTube video about this right now. But one of the main concerns I have about Ozempic and Wegovy and Mounjaro is that they're GLP-1 agonists. The GLP-1 receptor occurs all over the human body. It occurs in the brain. It occurs in the gut, for sure, no doubt. But it also occurs in the kidneys. It occurs in many different places in the human body. And so when you have a GLP-1 agonist like Ozempic, it's going to work on all these receptors. It's not just going to work on the receptors that the pharmaceutical company wants it to work on. That's the only receptors they want to talk about, of course, because that's going to make them probably hundreds of billions of dollars. Geez, I can't even imagine what the profits are going to be on these things. But again, the patients who are taking Ozempic right now, you are literally part of the long-term safety study. You are a lab rat right now if you're taking Ozempic or Wegovy. And so you have to know that up front. And then when you start to say, wait a minute, so there's GLP-1 receptors in the kidney? How does Ozempic affect those? What's the long-term outcome going to be of that? That, my friends, is a great question. And nobody on the planet knows the answer to that question. Currently, you're part of the study. We'll find out in 3 to 10 years. So if you're willing to take that risk, because the GLP-1 agonists, they definitely, you're going to lose fat. Absolutely. But when you start to muck around with a millions year old evolutionarily conserved mechanism like hunger, because that's what they do. They basically just muck up your hunger signal from your brain. So you're almost repulsed by food. Now, you know, people talk about, oh, if you fast or if you eat keto, that's an eating disorder, or you're liable to cause an eating disorder by doing that. You're telling me that a pharmaceutical that has no long-term data studies on safety, that basically turns off your hunger signals, or it transmutes them into like a feeling of mild nausea if you even think about eating. You don't think that sounds like an eating disorder? Because I do. But I predict that's going to end very, very, very badly. Okay, Susan's got a great question. Your thoughts on getting annual lipid profiles on children. Should we do that? At what age should we start? And would the adult ranges of normal be the same for kids?
So, you know, this... In some ways, I do support getting lipid profiles on children because metabolic syndrome is becoming predominant in children. And so, you know, again, I'm looking at that lipid profile different. I'm not looking at the LDL. I'm looking at the triglycerides and the HDL. And if that ratio is over 2 and those triglycerides are over 150 and really over 100, I'm going to be concerned about that. And yep. So that is the utility, I think, in getting these measurements on children. We know that our lipid profiles are different, as infants and young children. So, you know, you probably somewhere around 10 to 12 years old is where you settle into the adult values. But like I said, you know, knowing, and especially if the child is overweight or there's some other reason that you think that they might be insulin resistant, I would be interested in seeing the lipid profile because if we can make the changes directed at insulin resistance early in life, those effects are going to be extremely powerful. Unfortunately, most physicians and certainly the pharmaceutical industry is thinking, can we get these kids on cholesterol lowering medications early in life? And that is going to be disastrous. Absolutely. We think that lowering cholesterol is problematic in a 60 and 70 year old. I really don't even want to think about the effects of lowering cholesterol in a child who is still developing, a child who is going through puberty and all the hormonal changes. That is just a disastrous situation waiting to happen here. The unfortunate thing that I see as a heart surgeon is, you know, I am operating on younger and younger people. It is, you know, common for me to operate on people in their 40s these days, and it is not unusual that I'm operating on someone in their 30s. And realize that, you know, I started my career as a heart surgeon 20 years ago, only 20 years ago. And at that time, it was rare to be operating on people in their 50s. We were mostly operating on 70, 80-year-olds. And there has been a dramatic shift in the last 20 years as to the age of the patients that I am operating on. And that's because insulin resistance is showing up earlier and earlier. You know, we see type 2 diabetes, not childhood type 1 diabetes, but adult onset type 2 diabetes being diagnosed in teenagers routinely today.
It's very concerning.
And we can just do the math because we know it's, you know, 2 to 3 decades between when you first get diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and you end up with advanced heart disease. And so if you're getting diagnosed when you're 12, you're going to be on my operating room table at 30.
Yep.
And that is a major problem.
I totally agree. I got another question from a PhD tribe member. And if you're watching this on YouTube and you're like, how are these people able to ask Dr. Ovadia these questions? I want to ask a question. All these people are in our private community. There's a link down in the show notes. You can sign up. It's $5 a month, and you'll have immediate access to some of the leading authorities when it comes to human health and nutrition. That's how you do it. It's super simple. Liz says, I've been diagnosed with mitral valve stenosis. Should I still take a statin, and should I get a second opinion on my diagnosis?
Yeah, so a statin is going to do absolutely nothing for mitral valve stenosis. So again, to unpack this a little bit, the mitral valve, it's one of the valves in our heart. It controls the flow of blood, basically from the top part of the heart, the atria, to the bottom part of the heart, the ventricle, over on the left side of the heart. And stenosis means that it has become thickened. It has become, usually calcified, and it doesn't open like it should. And that's the heart is working extra hard to pump the blood past that obstruction, essentially. Statin medications will do absolutely nothing for that. Should you get a second opinion? I'm always in favor of getting a second opinion unless it's a life-threatening emergency.
Yep.
The usual questions around mitral stenosis become, when is it time to intervene on that? Typically, that's going to be a surgical procedure. There are some catheter-based procedures that can be done for mitral valve stenosis. The statin isn't going to help mitral valve stenosis.
Here's another good one from Susan. Small dents versus large fluffy is such a relatively new thing in the literature. Can we trust this early in science in this, that small dents is truly bad and large fluffy is truly good?
Yeah, so it's actually not that new of a thing. It hasn't been talked about, but the ability to differentiate particle sizes for cholesterol, goes back probably 30 years now, and maybe even before that. It hasn't been talked about. And really, why don't we talk about it? I think because it would reveal things that, we don't want to see. When you start looking at, cholesterol particle sizes, you start coming to some different conclusions that maybe don't support some of the interests we've been talking about. It's a lot, it's interesting when we look at it sort of from a marketing standpoint, the simple message of LDL high, prescribe a statin. It's a very simple message. It's simple for patients. It's simple for physicians. And it has been phenomenally successful in getting people on these medications. When you start getting into the complexity of particle sizes and that starts muddying the water, then we have problems. But I think the science on small dents versus large fluffy is very well established. And I do think we can trust that if you have a whole lot of large fluffy LDL and you don't have a lot small dense LDL, even if overall you have a lot of cholesterol, that is not a problematic situation. And the science continues to evolve. We're looking at it. There are ongoing studies. I know you've had Dave Feldman on here and you've talked about some of the scientific studies that his Citizen Science Foundation is leading. We want more studies. We want more information all the time. But I am pretty confident in, telling my patients that if you have a lot of large, fluffy LDL, that is not a problem.
Yep, I agree. Great question from Roxana, one of our leaders in the private group. Is a carotid artery scan, like a CIMT, a good test for overall cardiovascular health? And if so, why? If not, then what would you prefer?
Yeah, so, a carotid artery scan, first of all, understand that there are two types of carotid artery ultrasounds. There's the CIMT, so carotid intimal medial thickness, which is a very specific technique done with the ultrasound. And then there's the usual sort of carotid artery duplex study, it's called. That's the carotid artery duplex is only going to detect advanced plaques and advanced disease in the arteries. The CIMT scan is going to detect those more subtle changes in the lining of the artery that indicate atherosclerosis. So I do think the CIMT is a good test, but it's still an indirect test. If we're worried about disease in the heart, let's get the scan that looks at the disease in the heart. And so I always prefer a CAC scan. That doesn't mean that, CIMT can't also be used. Certainly if your CIMT is abnormal, you want to get a CAC score. But I do see people with normal CIMTs that have abnormal coronary artery calcium scores. And that's the disease we're concerned about. Let's get the test to look for it directly.
Love it. And tell us the pros and cons and in what clinical situation you would order a CAC scan versus a CT angiogram of the heart. Yeah. What are the strengths and weaknesses of those two tests?
Yeah, so the the disadvantage of the CAC scan is it only shows calcified plaque. And we know that you can have non-calcified plaque. So you're not going to see that on the CAC scan. You'll see that on a CT angiogram. And the drawback of the CT angiogram is that you need to have dye injected. It's a more expensive test. It has more radiation involved than the CAC scan. So typically, if I'm just screening, if I just want to know if the patient has any evidence of heart disease, I'm going to start with a CAC scan. Now, if I have reason to be concerned that someone already has significant heart disease, and I really want to know what's going on in those blood vessels, that's when I'm going to get the CT angiogram. So this may be because a patient's having symptoms, like the earlier questioner, or this may be because we got the CAC scan and it shows that the patient has, moderate or severe calcification. And now we got to get a better picture to really see what's going on there.
What else in closing, Doc, what else do you want everybody out there to know, want them to consider, want them to ask their doctor at the next follow-up visit? Give us kind of a summation of how we should be thinking about heart disease going into the future.
Yeah, I think, the questions we've been talking about are the ones that you should be asking your doctors more and more. Why aren't you talking to me about insulin resistance? Why are you only focused on cholesterol? We just have to advocate for our health. You can't be passive about your health. You need to take an active role. You can't depend on your doctors. And it's not because your doctors are bad people. It's because your doctors are overworked, overwhelmed, and trapped in a system that isn't focused on keeping you healthy. The only one that's going to be focused on keeping you healthy is you. So you have to advocate for yourself. Sometimes that's going to take some work. Your local doctor may not be the best option for you. You might have to travel. You might have to get online. Your insurance company might not pay for some of these things sometimes, but that's a worthwhile investment in your health. So be your own advocate is really the message that I emphasize to people.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I love how you put that. Don't think of, my insurance doesn't cover that test. Therefore, I'm not even going to consider it because that's an unnecessary expense. If you think that your insurance company is the best gauge of whether something is an expense or an investment, you, my friend, are deluded. Any of this testing that we've talked about today, if your insurance doesn't cover that, that is not an expense. That is an investment in your current health and your future health. Absolutely. Save up the money, borrow the money. Don't steal the money. That's not nice. But you got it. You got to have these tests checked because knowing this not only uncovers perhaps hidden disease, but it also uncovers the false paradigm that your doctor may be practicing under. Just like the CGM, many people, if you don't have type 2 diabetes, your insurance is not going to pay for that. you need a CGM for a few weeks. And not only for your own self to go, oh my God, I thought oatmeal with bananas, I thought that was one of the ultimate health foods in the world. But every time I eat that, my blood sugar goes to 200. Not only do Dr. Ovadia and I want you to know that, we also want you to tell your doctor that, because your doctor is probably deluded as well. But when enough patients go back to them and say, Doc, I spent the money for a CGM, and I found out every time I eat oatmeal and bananas, my blood sugar goes to 200. Is that healthy? How's that possibly good for me? The first time your doctor hears that, they'll think, well, you're just an outlier or a kook. You're just crazy. I don't know. But when they've heard that 10, 20, 30 times, that's going to shake their current paradigm and make them go, well, shit, I don't know why this is happening to all these people. I swear, I thought that was a healthy breakfast. I thought that Fruit Loops and Reese's Puffs cereal were healthy breakfast because the one of the preeminent schools of nutrition in the world, Tufts, said it's okay, it's a green light to eat Reese's Puffs every single damn morning. But when my patients do it, their blood sugar goes over 200. So there's something dead in Denmark here. Something's rotten. Something stinks. I don't understand what's going on, but I need to put my student hat back on, because I used to be a good student back in medical school. That's how I got through. I need to put my student hat back on, and I need to start investigating what's going on here, because SAR, did you guys have that when you were in residency? It means shit ain't right. And anytime you didn't know what was wrong, but something was wrong, you're like, SAR right there. We gotta figure this out. So SAR, docs, if this food that's get a green light from Tufts is making people's blood sugar go over 200, SAR, you got to look into that. And if you haven't looked into that, then are you truly doing your job as a doctor? Dr. Ovadia, man, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. In case people watching this don't know, Dr. Ovadia and I both went to Costa Rica. We were experts at the recent reversed carnivore edition that is coming out sometime in the future. We don't know when and we don't know where, so don't ask us. When we find out, we'll announce it. But we were down there with a great panel of experts and some wonderful people in Costa Rica talking about a carnivore diet. Any parting words, doctor?
No, just great being with you here, Ken. Great being a partner with you on this mission. Some other real exciting things that we're working on that aren't quite ready for announcement yet, but will be coming soon. And I encourage everyone out there to, take back control of their health and find the support of docs like Ken and myself to help you in that.
Absolutely. And you can find Dr. Ovadia at iFixHearts. I think that's his handle on all social media. And I'm going to post a link to his book, Stay Off My Operating Table, that you can get at, I'll have an Amazon link, but you can get it at any bookstore. There's also an Audible of his book for people with ADHD like myself who have to be doing something while they read a book. Dr. Philip Ovadia, thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure. I'll see you next time.